Salutations. This is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games, and I'm Nick Folkman.
I'm Max Folkman, and today's guests are Mitch Dyer and Damian Lin. Mitch is a writer at EA Motive, where he worked on Star Wars Battlefront 2 and Star Wars Battlefront 2 Resurrection. Previously, he was an editor at IGN and a freelance writer for publications like GameSpot, Ars Technica, The Escapist, GamesRadar, and more. Damian was an executive producer at Ziff Davis Media, 1UP.com, and Game Videos, as well as a co-founder of Bitmob Media. He's currently a game writer at Ubisoft San Francisco, where he just finished working on South Park, The Fractured Butthole. Thanks for coming on the show, you two.
Yeah, nope, sure. That was very comprehensive.
Yeah, it's nice. I'm just going to clip that out and give it to people every time. They're like, who are you?
So we'll start with you, Mitch. How'd you break into the industry?
So about a decade ago, I started writing freelance without really knowing what that mean. What that meant. So I thought, oh, I like these video game magazines, and Damian worked at plenty of those. And I was really eager to make that, right? Like, oh, this thing I get every month, it's got demo discs, it's got previews and interviews and all this stuff that I like to learn about the industry. I guess that's a thing. I didn't know there was an industry. It was just this window into video games that I didn't really know existed, right? So around 2008, I just started, and I'd been, you know, in high school and a little bit before, just decided, like, I'm going to be a writer. It's the only thing I'm good at. I'm passing that class and nothing else. I thought, I'll see if I can try to apply this to video games. I'll see, you know, try to find out if there's a way I can work for one of these magazines. And this was around the time magazines were slowly starting to get on the way out. There was Official Xbox Magazine, EGM, I think was still around by then. Correct me if I'm wrong, Damian. But there were still a few at the time. So it was like right at that tail end of that. And I got in through Dan Amrick, who's now at Ubisoft. And he was at Official Xbox Magazine. And he was my guy, man. He was the guy who... He listened to all my emails and IM conversations and questions, and he was just like the kindest, warmest dude when it came to how do I get paid to do this? How do I make this a career? How do I get an editorial job? So Dan was really my first step into magazine writing, and at OXM, I had this crazy lucky breakthrough where I started out doing stuff for their website, and eventually they asked me if I wanted to do reviews. And I said, yeah, that'd be great, but I don't have a debug console. Because at the time, you needed a developer debug console for the Xbox 360 to play pre-release software. And they just sent me one. They had me one sent. And as a freelancer, that was the most valuable thing I could imagine ever happening to me, because it wasn't super common. So that meant instant access to basically every website and magazine around, right? Like GamePro and GameSpot and IGN and all these companies, I was just immediately accessible to them. So I kind of cut my teeth writing for OXM and branched out to all these other websites and magazines and got into the Games Press that way. A few years of that, I ended up at IGN in 2011 full-time. Moved to California from my tiny Canadian small town, so it was a bit of culture shock to go to San Francisco, California in 2012 to work at IGN full-time. And I spent almost 5 years at IGN doing videos and previews and events like Tokyo Game Show, and I got to, you know, do all the crazy fun stuff you get to do as someone in the media, right? Like, I got to meet all the people who make the games I love, and I got to travel the world and go to these events and play all these games before they came out. And it was kind of living the dream. But in the course of meeting all the people who made the stuff I loved and talking to them about the craft and just how games get made, it seemed like something I would be interested in, but not particularly good at, right? Like, game dev as a skill set, it's not really welcoming to writers in a lot of ways. Like, you need to have a lot of practical applications and understanding of tools and all these kinds of things that, you know, if you're just some idiot writing Far Cry reviews and, you know, kind of writing short stories for yourself and your own time, that's not a marketable skill set to a video game developer. But what ended up happening is, I guess I had a breadth and depth of knowledge about the industry that Jade Raymond and Amy Hennig found attractive, because they, when I contacted them about potential jobs at Motive working on Star Wars, they were both immediately really interested in talking to me, which was surprising because I had never done anything like this before. And I just kind of blindly emailed Jade and said, hey, if you need writers, let me know. and she was very happy to talk to me and hear my ideas. And, you know, that kind of, that conversation led to Amy Hennig recommending me, cause we'd been, you know, we'd been friends for a while, and Amy had been trying to get me to jump the fence for some time and find the right thing for me. And she went to bat for me. Jade went to bat for me, and I moved to Montreal to make Battlefront in April 2016.
So were you writing like your own stories during all this before you got into actually writing games?
Yeah, but not even seriously, right? Like I had a like my Google Drive is like my quote portfolio, and it was just lots of random incomplete ideas, right? It was super short stories, it was chapters, it was incomplete things that were never fully fleshed out. Lots of wayward incomplete stuff, but it was almost entirely prose. I had never really written a screenplay. I had never seen what a video game script looked like. I hadn't ever considered, hey, you want to write 1,000 barks by Monday? See what that process is like? I did writing for myself just to, because it was something I enjoyed. I didn't do it as often as I would have liked, but it was something that kind of just, I couldn't turn off. And I kept coming back to as a way to, you know, find a new creative outlet outside of... I guess what is more nonfiction-esque writing in the games press.
And so like you kind of knew you want to work in games from like an early age, right?
Yeah, but I think I did, but it wasn't like, oh, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to go work for these magazines. I'm going to go work for Damien at Bitmop. I'm going to get a job at IGN, and then I'm going to be a game developer, right? Like it was never like it's going to be the thing that leapfrogs me from one to the next. For me, the end game was always full-time editor at a magazine. Magazines kind of went away, and I was like, "Well, maybe a website. Websites are cool." And IGN was obviously and remains like the biggest video game website on the planet. It does like wild traffic numbers that I still don't believe. Right, like the amount of people that go and read IGN articles and watch IGN videos is preposterous to me. And it was very strange going from being a freelance writer who, you know, I'd have like a 300-word review in a magazine to, okay, you're going to do a video and it's going to get 1 million views.
I don't understand the scale of that.
I don't either. And that was my everyday, right? It was like, oh, only 100,000 people read this article. It didn't actually do that well. It's 100,000 human beings. That's a lot. But I guess, weirdly, game dev is the same way. Like, oh, only 3 million people, right? Yeah. It's like, depending on the scale of your game, it's wild to think that that's not the right amount of people to turn a profit.
Hmm. And this is a question I want to ask Damien, too. But, like, Mitch, when you kind of knew you wanted to work as a game writer or started thinking about that, did working in the games press make you more excited to work in game development, or did you kind of dread it more because of your knowledge from working in games press?
A bit of both, and it was probably more dread than anything else, but it was also like the stuff that I heard a lot of my writer friends, because I made a lot of friends with writers in the games industry, one of whom became my co-writer on Star Wars Battlefront 2. But I would hear their horror stories, and I would, you know, listen to them talk about like how things happened and the realities of writing a game, and how, you know, maybe game writers aren't the most respected within studios, and you got to really fight to get stuff in that you really care about, and all these kinds of things. Like, man, it sounds horrible, but I still want to do it. Right? It's this strange masochistic thing of like, that sounds awful. Sign me up.
So is that like the same for you, Damien?
Yeah, I mean, I had kind of a roundabout way of getting into the industry. Way back in the sepia tone 90s, I was really obsessed with cars, and writing was like the only thing that I could do well. So I was interested in writing for car magazines, and I managed to get an internship at Automobile Magazine because I lived in Michigan. And that led to taking a year off from college and working for a car magazine in London. So I was there for a while as an editorial assistant, went back and finished school in Michigan, and then went back to London again for about a year and a half. And so I was a road tester on a car magazine, driving a bunch of different stuff. And then Gran Turismo came out. And I'd always been into games, but hadn't really thought about pursuing writing about games. And then when Gran Turismo came out, I just realized that video games were going to be a lot more exciting over the next few decades than the automotive industry. And so I moved back to Michigan again and ended up getting a QA job on Descent 3, while also writing reviews for a new kind of alt-weekly newspaper that was starting up in the Detroit area. And from that, eventually I got a job at a magazine that was starting up in San Francisco, and they were going to pay to move me out. So I was like, all right, let's do it. And that lasted about 10 months before the magazine folded. And I did freelance for a while. I wrote some strategy guides for such beloved games as Scorpion King. And eventually I managed to get a job at Electronic Gaming Monthly, and loved working there. It was a great group of people. I was there for quite a while, moved on to writing or helping out with 1UP.com, doing some writing there, and also launching the video department and helping with the 1UP show. And then for those who remember that. And then
I love the 1UP show.
Oh, me too. Good.
Yeah, it was a labor of love for everybody. But it was a little bit before its time. It was not getting those 1 in 2 million views that you guys were getting over at IGN. And after a while, I decided I wanted to try, I wanted to start something up that was Bitmob with Dan Hsu. And that was kind of a community sourced editorial. And we did that for a while, and that kind of became part of VentureBeat and GamesBeat. And then there were a few years when I was in the wilderness doing kind of a non-creative job, and was really miserable at the time, and realized that I really needed to be writing again. But I didn't want to write about games anymore. I was more interested in writing the games themselves. So I was looking for game writing jobs for a long time. It was a really tough process. I did a lot of writing tests, and luckily I had, you know, a lot of industry contacts, because I mean, these jobs are already few and far between and hard to get, and a lot of times they're not even advertised. Totally. You know, like Mitch's story, you just kind of cold emailed. I mean, not totally cold. You emailed people you knew, but it wasn't a job that was probably being advertised. So, I was close to a job at 2K. I was in the running for Massive Chalice over at Double Fine, but I know that that you guys ended up.
I did
up
not know that. Sorry about that.
No problem.
You could have snuffed out Damien's dreams before they became a reality, boys.
Oh man.
Yeah, well, this podcast appearance is actually the end game of a very long con in which I get back at you guys by tanking this episode of your podcast.
Oh man.
But then the opportunity at Ubisoft came along, and did a writing test that I loved, and met everyone, and it went great. And been here for 2 years, and it's been amazing.
All right, so I have a couple questions. One was, how was QA?
It was more fun than the stories that you usually hear, but I think it was kind of unique to that project and the people I was working with. It was Descent 3 was really just a super fun game to play, so I didn't really get tired of it in that respect. But yeah, I mean, in general, QA is definitely a challenging role. Doesn't get a lot of respect. Can be really long hours. Can be very tedious. But you know, it is a good way into kind of a producer track at a game developer, or if you've got other skills like art and programming, it's a good way to get into those.
And when you were working in magazines, like in San Francisco, were you always working towards like game writing, or was some other job you were working towards, or you thought you were working towards?
No, I wasn't always. That definitely wasn't always the end goal. It was just something that I thought of as I kind of came to a reckoning in my career, like, okay, what am I good at? What, you know, gives me joy to actually do? Cause I need to have jobs where I'm not miserable all day. And it just kind of clicked that writing games would be a really good fit.
Did you have a writing background before then?
Well, I mean, I have a creative writing degree, and you know, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the thing that I've always done that I've enjoyed the most. So
okay, and did like working in gaming press and learning more about game development and like the QA job, did that make you? Did it give you pause about working in game development yourself, or did you get more excited about working in it?
Yeah, I mean, there was kind of a moment after Descent 3 shipped where I could have stayed on at that studio and moved into some kind of junior writing role on whatever their next project was going to be. But it was a little bit up in the air. But then the offer came in to move to San Francisco, and I just thought, well, this sounds like a lot of fun, so I'm just going to do it. But, you know, sometimes I think about what would happen if I had stayed with that developer, Outrage Entertainment, and gone into game writing a lot earlier.
What did they make after Descent 3?
They made a game called Alter Echo.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's wow. Brad Muir's game.
Yes, that's right.
Man, that's a long time ago.
Yep.
That's a weird game, too.
It is, totally.
It's very different than Descent 3. Yep.
Yeah, it had some interesting kind of music rhythm components to the combat, which was kind of like an action hack and slash sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting game.
It's some weird visuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty
psychedelic.
Did
you meet Brad there?
Brad joined after I left. I had a really good friend who was still there, who's now out in San Francisco. But he's been in game development all along. And he's good friends with Brad.
Okay. This is more of a question for both of you. And did either of you have any assumptions about game writing and or game development going in that were incorrect?
Oh, God. So many. I'm just trying to remember what they were. Oh, man. I think the easiest assumption that a lot of people make is you assume that, okay, you know, game writing is they make a game and then you make a script and you make that game make sense. And that's kind of true, but the ways that games are written are much more chaotic than I expected. I didn't anticipate how much narrative churn there would be, how much you would throw away, how much work gets thrown away. Especially in production when things are constantly changing, levels are changing, that level's cut. We can't afford this character model anymore, so that character has to go, right? You assume that production is all the pieces are available to us. Now we will put them in order and put it on a disc. And that is not at all the case.
And there's no one way to do a game script or like to do game writing. It changes on every project. And even if you go in writing wanting to do it one way, it almost never goes that way.
Yeah, I had once asked a friend, like, hey, what does a video game script look like? So if I want to do a writing test or I need to prep for a writing test, like, what am I in for? And he said, oh, it looks like this. And he showed me four completely different documents that were not remotely comparable in any way. Like, one of them was
Excel documents.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have scene descriptions and action and level design layouts and encounter beats all laid out in a spreadsheet. I can't wrap my head around that process.
Anytime we try to get stuff together for like a resume or like for writing samples, we always have to like reformat whatever stuff we've written because none of it makes sense to someone who has never worked in that game. Do either of you know about the WGA, their submissions for the award for like game writing?
No.
Companies, when they want to like submit themselves to the award, they have to submit a script of the game. It has to be formatted like a final draft document. It has to be one script.
What?
No longer than 300 pages.
What?
Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
And there's a fee you have to pay for it too.
I'm really
like, what do you do if you're the Witcher? Do you just lie? Like, yeah, this is, we rewrote 300 pages. Here you go.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
I'm really thankful at Ubisoft that we don't do our writing in Excel the way a lot of projects do. We've got some custom tools for all that are a little more writer friendly.
I have no problem with Excel. Like, it's fine. Like maybe with the longer projects that are more like super story heavy, then it would probably be a problem for us. But the things we've worked on have been way smaller. And so they've been like
manageable.
Yeah, whatever.
That's actually, I'm going to turn it around. I'm going to interview you guys real quick. What, as freelance writers, what is it like if you go to work at a studio, AAA or any other kind, how do you convince them, like, yeah, we can do this from the outside, right? Like, we don't need your engine. We don't need the tools that talk to your engine. We can write it from outside. Because that's like the dream, right? Like, I'm going to work on as many things as I can from home. Perfect. But I just, like, I can't imagine having a full-time writer remote because of how much I need my tools day to day.
It's really hard. That's the biggest thing.
And it's like,
usually when we're brought in, like, we work on stuff, they're far enough in development that it's always different. But like, we did one project earlier this year. It's probably like the biggest budget thing we worked on that hasn't been announced. But this is literally a thing where
they had their own tools, but it was too much of a hassle to have us learn their tool set and send it to us. So
they exported file draft files of this huge script, like, of all these different scenes.
That's branching.
That was all branching. So like, each scene was like,
oh my God,
person X enters scene, sees body on the floor, says a line of dialogue. And then after that, six more scenes of that exact same scene, but with different characters depending if they're alive or dead.
Yeah. Encountering the same like story beat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's combinations of characters too.
So it'd be just, it's like, that job is literally, all right, guys, we don't have a lot of time because we're recording with the actors. Write as much of this as you can, and we'll pay you for whatever you do.
Yeah.
So that was literally just like, okay, we're going to file a draft. And it's the biggest challenge is write variations for all these dialogue lines that
But most of the time it's like, they have their tool sets or their formats like Excel or
Inkle,
Google Docs or Inkle. And it's like, either we already know it beforehand or do a quick like running start of, okay, we'll learn all this stuff really quickly and learn on the go and do it and
talk with their programmers at the same time. Like, they'll be giving us notes and like, here's how you can fix, like, work faster in the future.
Yeah, usually it hasn't been like a huge hassle for us because we're always excited to like, oh man, I get to learn something new. Or like, hey, I really like this project. This will be fun to work on this. Or it's a fun writing challenge. But it hasn't been ridiculous yet. That answers your question all the way.
It does. How often are you guys involved in like the conceptual phase of stuff?
Very rarely.
Okay.
Yeah, like freelance. I don't know of a lot of freelancers that start.
The stuff we've involved in at the beginning has either been canceled or indefinitely postponed.
So you've got a great track record, is what you say.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we brought on this one thing that was like, hey, this company only did this kind of game before that was not story-based at all, and they want to do story games now. So they brought us on and some other writers like, hey, help us figure out how to do story games. So then we taught them what we know and then had some really weird meetings and then did a bunch of writing for them. 6 months later, they're like, hey, we don't want to do this anymore because this kind of sucks.
This is hard.
Yeah. I don't know if we're going to keep your stuff or like put out a game out, but here's the money. And that's like, I don't. It would be cool to work on a game from the very beginning that comes out. Like, that'd be really sweet.
But I've never heard of any freelance job that you're involved in the inception, at least for the stuff we've worked on.
So yeah. How do you guys get freelance jobs? I mean, it seems like you know a lot of
people. It's almost always been people we've known and like getting tons of people. We've gotten the job that was canceled/postponed. That one I found because of a listing
on Twitter.
Yeah, Twitter.
It's like Twitter has helped a lot, just like meeting people and like, hey, you're doing this thing? Here, I'll send my resume to you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how we usually get our stuff. Yeah.
But we're also like, we're doing comics and video games right now because it's hard enough getting like stable work as a freelancer. So just we're trying to jump between mediums as much as we can.
Yeah, besides like, I think we know two people who can do consistent freelance video game work. Everyone else are either struggling or doing other jobs at the same time that aren't video games. I don't know if it's feasible to be a freelance video game writer full-time for like a good consistent amount of time.
Unless you live in like the Midwest, like somewhere with really low rent.
And you already own your house.
Yeah. And maybe you're in like Montreal or LA where there's like a bunch of studios.
One of the things that I was finding frustrating when I was applying for some like contract type game writing jobs is that I would get the feeling back from the people that I was talking to that they were kind of looking for me to guess the tone they wanted for their game, or maybe it's more accurate that they didn't really know what tone they wanted yet, and they were just looking for you to magically present it without really understanding that part of what you can do is, you know, come up with all kinds of different tones.
Yeah. We had phone interviews that, like, we hadn't been hired on the job. It was just, like, after we applied, I think maybe did a writing test, and then it sent us a bunch of documents, like, here's the game. And we do a phone interview. And then they open up by saying, so what would you do? And it's, like, we just we just got, like, we don't know. We haven't talked to you about this. It's like, what do you guys want to do? Like, it's not our project. I always felt really weird when they would expect us to come forward with a bunch of new ideas before they even hired us.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
And depending on the writing test, it is very frustrating. It was like, here, do this like 5-page writing test. It's like not paid.
Like 5,000 words, mm-hmm. 10,000 words.
Yeah.
Yeah. A friend of mine once said that game writing is the only job you have to prove that you know how to do every time you start again.
Yeah.
Because you can't just say, here's the game that I wrote. Here's the $60 boxed package, right? You have to do a writing test, and that writing test has to lead to all sorts of other compatibility things with the, it's a lot.
I would hope that like people who are more established, like Eric Wolpa, I assume if he would ever go for like a freelance job, he would not have to do a writing test. Like you just go look at his work and like go, okay, yeah, he could, he knows how to write.
Got it figured out.
Yeah. I still want to hear your answer to this, Damien, of, do you have any assumptions about game writing or game development going in that were incorrect?
Well, you know, going in, I had heard a lot from other people who had done the same thing. I'm sure you've heard a million times too. It's just that, you know, you never realize how difficult things are to change or add or tweak until you're kind of in it and understand all the moving parts. I mean, I definitely experienced that, but I was kind of expecting that was going to happen.
Okay. Or wait, no, I got a follow-up question. Are there aspects of writing games that you wish the media or fans understood better?
Writers are not as powerful as you think.
Yeah. I'm trying to think, I often think about like what did I used to write about games that would kind of drive me up the wall now? And I think that, I don't know, there's just so many things that, I think it's all small stuff, right? Like, it's not like there's this big thing that's so obvious. It's like, oh, this little tiny thing that's not really even worth talking about because it's so minuscule and so boring that, like, it's not going to change anyone's perception. I can't think of anything, like, super specific.
Was there any of the small stuff that you can think of?
Yeah, I mean, I've got a tiny thing that you might not think of if you haven't been doing game development before. Like we were working on the latest story DLC for South Park, and you know, there's a part where there's a map of an area that you can kind of interact with, there's just, I'll use that as an example. Like, if say there's a map that you want the character to interact with, and you know, see it in game, it's not easy to have writing on it, because then that all needs to be localized, and then there needs to be an art asset made for that in all the different languages that you're localizing to. It's just all these sorts of little things that you wouldn't expect that are kind of impacting what's in the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can reach a point like, if you're playing a game and you think like, oh, something that you lose the plot, something doesn't make sense. That could be as simple as, you know, a line was written and recorded and it was awesome, but for some reason it didn't fire. And now it's like, well, the writing doesn't make any sense. Shit. Oh man, I really thought that was a good line and it just didn't fire. That's a bummer that it's perceived as like a gap that is a hyper specific fringe case, and it sucks that someone had that experience and there's not really anything you can do about those kinds of situations.
I know this has come up before on previous episodes. And I feel like this is a thing that happens both with journalists and probably more with general players, but like people complain about X thing in game. It's like, well, why didn't developers know about this? And it's like,
they sure did.
Believe me, they totally did.
And somebody probably just screamed about it for 6 months trying to get it fixed, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah, yeah. And no one could talk about it publicly.
Yeah. Like a lot of the time you see people discuss things, and obviously, like, I think it's completely fine for critics to criticize things as they ship, because that's what it is, that's what you're paying for, that's what the experience is. But sometimes I think it's like a very good compromise that you made to make something work and make sense. If it's still not good enough, it's like, yeah, I understand that where that criticism comes from, but I wish I could tell you how we got here, and I can't ever.
Along that line, no, this is not really related to it, but for both of you, what is the biggest storytelling mistake you've made so far that you can talk about, that you've learned from?
Man.
I can field that one first. I mean, my working with South Park was a little bit unique or specific in that, you know, you're kind of walking into a world that has existed for a long time, and the voices are very established. So about a month or two on the job, and I had been writing stuff, and I hadn't really gotten a lot of feedback from South Park Studios. And I finally got to make a trip down there and meet all those guys and just kind of talk about, you know, our working relationship and all that stuff. I'm the new guy. And one of the things that Matt Stone said to me was like, not every line has to be a joke. And that gave me some freedom a bit because, you know, it's not really possible to have every single line be a joke, and it's just too much density. That kind of helped me out.
By the way, Damien, when you were talking, I just realized I totally forgotten that Nick and I have did a writing test for South Park.
Vengeance!
That was one of the hardest tests I think we've ever done, trying to get those voices.
Yeah, they're very distinct.
That was a big writing test, too.
That was,
okay, I'm gonna answer this question eventually, but now I'm gonna interject and do an interview. You guys mentioned that you guys all did writing tests for Yubi. What were those writing tests like? If you can talk about it, process there? Like, what was the kind of writing? How many rounds did you have to go? That kind of stuff.
It was one test, one round. And there were a number of different sections. There were things like, you know, here's this character in the game, you know, Cartman. He's in a raccoon suit. You know the episodes that the game is related to or had already been out. So of course I'd watch those. And the exercises would be like write five lines for when Cartman hits an enemy with a certain move, or write five item descriptions for some specific thing. It was mostly stuff like that. It was like really short form. It was Barks, basically. I'm trying to remember if there was anything longer form. There were like some short discussion bits to write, like dialogue, a short exchange between two characters about some specific thing. But they were only like, you know, two or three back and forth lines.
And I remember it ended with like, they're at this stage, right? This like scene, dialogue exchange that mentions this stage and where they're at. Yeah, it was a lot of Barks, a lot of here's a scenario, do a dialogue scene around the scenario. All it was dialogue. I don't think there's anything for weapons or item descriptions.
That's interesting because it's very focused, right? It's very much like you are writing a video game, achieve the video game and the voice, and that's the metric for success. As opposed to a lot of writing tests I've heard about and I've helped some friends out with, it's usually like write a scene and try to get the voice and the tone and the characters, but it's really a screenplay. And so much of video games is not writing a screenplay.
Yeah. I've done the scene ones where it had to be like 1 to 2 page scenes of just dialogue going back and forth with these like established IP characters. And then we were just talking about this past week for an interview, but the Master Chalice writing test had a big section of like, what do you think the tone of the game is? And what are your media touchstones are, in addition to like writing dialogue scenes and item weapon descriptions.
Yeah.
And like just actual text blocks or stories.
Like prose.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most writing tests usually have some of the more screenwriting type dialogue, at least sections to them. South Park one, I mean, it's kind of a unique project in that the most important thing is nailing the character's voice.
Yeah. Mitch, was one of your failures?
Oh, my failures. I think in hindsight, looking at Battlefront 2, and obviously I won't go into too many specifics because I don't want to, because I am super, super happy and proud of that game. So I don't want to dunk on myself too much, but I think that the hardest lesson I learned in writing that game, because it was my first game, which is wild, give me the biggest IP on the planet as my first thing, was we put a lot of heavy, heavy narrative moments that had like a chain reaction across future missions. In every mission, so every mission had a major thing that cascaded into the next mission, that cascaded into the next mission. And hey, that makes sense. You're making a linear action game, sequence of events. It's very narrative heavy because it's Star Wars. It's all like that. It made sense. And to me, in hindsight, it still does. And if I did it, a game like that again, I'd probably make the same mistake. But the problem with that is If you do that and you cut mission 5 out of 8 or, you know, mission 10 out of 13, you suddenly have this enormous gap where you have this big story beat that's super important for that mission and super important for every mission that comes after. You now have a lot of retroactive changes to make across every single other mission to accommodate for the fact that this moment isn't happening. This character doesn't make that decision. This action beat doesn't ever occur. Somebody else does something. It gets out of control. And if you're not super diligent about paying attention to that kind of stuff, you can get to a situation where you're contradicting yourself or the plot gets totally wrapped up in itself. And I think we had a couple moments like that just led to some lost moments of clarity that I wish I could just give a couple extra lines of context to that would very easily resolve those problems. But in the moment, it's hard, right? Like when you're writing something and you're that close to it for that many months or years, it's really challenging to recognize when something isn't exactly what you want it to be, or to realize like, oh, it's not the same thing it's been for 6 years all of a sudden, right?
Yeah. And shouldn't, like, the way you're doing things originally with like the big dramatic beats that lead to one mission, to another mission, to another mission, that should be the ideal way for writing a linear story for games, because it's like I think it's actually Trey Parker and Matt Stone who talked about this, where the storytelling tenets they go by of if this, then this, but then this happens.
Yeah, if but
it's like the ideal and not the this and this and this and this. But like there is a problem of development happens and maybe you have to cut out a mission in between everything and then you have to Frankenstein a solution to it, which it's like there's no way to plan for that.
Yeah, I mean, if you put all your eggs into a certain basket and that feature gets cut, right? Like we had a feature that we had to cut that we had a lot of extra narrative content in. Just, you know, context and additional info. Like if you're like me and you're like, oh, I really want to get engaged with this aspect of the Star Wars universe. I really want to dig into the narrative. Great. Okay, here's the avenue where we're going to do that. We'd write a ton of content for it. And now that that feature is cut because, hey, we have a limited time, limited resources, only so many people, we just can't do it. Okay, cool, right? That's just gone. All of the content you were going to put in that bucket doesn't exist or needs to be relocated. And if you're relying on that feature to communicate certain things that are important and you just don't have space for them, now they just don't exist, right? And, it's one of those things where, and I think Star Wars is a good example of this, right? Where if it's not on screen, it, for the average viewer, doesn't exist, right? Like nobody expects anybody to go read an expanded universe novel to understand the real moment, the real meaning behind that moment, or the what this reference is all about and how significant it is. Because in the moment when you're playing something or you're watching something, you're only seeing what you're seeing. And if there's nothing there, or if there's supposed to be something there that's not anybody's fault, but yours.
Yeah. And I want to backtrack a little bit to what you're talking about, like sticking with the project for so long and not being always able to see if there's a problem there. And I want to hear both of your thoughts. Like, how do you stay objective about the work you're doing, like where you can see the forest for the trees when you're working on a project for so many years or like for so long?
Go for it, Damien. Well, go for it. Or I can answer if you need time to think.
I mean, a big part of it, there's kind of a big reality check once you start actually playing through the game and you hear lines firing, because, you know, you can be writing stuff for months and months and months before you get to that stage, or years before you get to that stage. And then when you see how it feels to actually play through it, what the pacing is like, and that's definitely a time when you have to kind of reevaluate, like, all right, does everything still work here? But, you know, I was lucky in some respects that we had kind of an external force thinking about all those things, which was the South Park studio guys.
Yeah, Lucasfilm Story Group was really good for that as well, right? Like, there's a pattern between us, Damien. We both work on big IPs with reliable source material. Having that kind of touchstone for the franchise you're working on is really helpful. And I think it's something I think about for any IP, right? New IP, anything else, is like having a group of people to keep you accountable to the material is really, really important. And whether that group of people is your writer's room or narrative QA or an external force like the Story Group or South Park Studios, like that kind of stuff can really elevate the story that you're putting into a game. And it's something that I'm very mindful of now, because as I work on something every day, I'm constantly questioning myself, because I'm trying not to be too hard on work that is throwaway and meant to be one step on in a very long process. And I'm constantly bringing in people from the concept art team and character artists and animators, just people who I trust who have a good eye for narrative, to look at stuff I'm doing and say, like, don't do that. That's not good enough. So I don't know. I'm constantly checking my work and questioning everything I'm doing, probably through insecurity, but also just for good measure.
When do either of you know you're done with writing something and ready to hand it off? Or is it just the deadline? Yeah, like us.
I know a lot of writers like to kind of bash out a draft really quickly and then go through and tweak it and tweak it until it's just how they want it. I kind of work in the opposite way. I'm constantly revising and tweaking things that I've done as I'm going and before I've finished. So by the time I actually get to the end of something, I'm pretty much there, unless there's some kind of major structural change that I realize needs to happen. But yeah, I'll give it a read through and punt it off.
Oh man, you and I are opposite beings, Damien. I will very specifically go into something. I will write the worst first draft imaginable just to have something, right? Just to have ink on a page. I'm very, yeah, very, very happy to have a character saying, like, something super literal, like have temporary lines that you know are going to be replaced, right? Have somebody say, I'm angry now, so that you know that later on that's the subtext of the dialogue you need to write. Super on the nose stuff like that, just to figure out the shape of a scene, and then I'll iterate on it over and over and over. On Battlefront, we were rewriting even like literally in the middle of a shoot. We would be updating the script. Less for my neuroses and more because the actors were constantly having input and ideas. And we tried to be super adaptable when we were filming Battlefront 2. So we were constantly changing tone and changing intention of a scene right down to the last minute before it was on film.
Is that stressful?
It is horrendously stressful. And it doesn't always work, right? Because you're making these decisions because, man, it's like the scene is so much more interesting and powerful and dramatic or funny or whatever because of these changes. And then you get back and you realize, oh, shit, it doesn't fit. Right? These puzzle pieces don't fit anymore. We're going from a scene that ends really dramatically to something that starts way funnier than we intended. We need to make a change. We got to either have something to bridge those, or we need to reshoot one of those scenes. But when it works, it's amazing. When you have a scene that, you know, it's pretty good, everyone's happy with it, it's approved by internal and external partners, everyone's like, yes, good, get it to set, get it to the actors. And the actors have it memorized. And then they change it because they're smarter than you a lot of the time. It's wild to see something you wrote get into somebody else's hands and just see how their creative energy affects that. And it gives you new ideas in the moment. And I don't know. It's a good process for me because I'm so nitpicky about things. Like, I'm constantly just changing syntax. Anyway, it's like meaningless stuff, right? The scene's done, but I'm like, no, just one more second, one more thing. I can do this one tiny tweak.
You mentioned the internal, external teams like approving stuff. I'm assuming the answer is like it's big, but like Damien and Mitch, is the approval process for scripts and everything pretty elaborate because you're working on both big franchises?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of funny for my situation. The approval process was more like, okay, we sent a bunch of lines to South Park. Did they record them? did we get audio back? Oh, we got like 80%.
Do you ever get lines back that were different?
Yeah,
like,
they would.
Because those guys are improv, right? Like, they do so much improv and they change stuff with the show so often. I'm curious, like, do you get lines back that are different that you didn't
write? Yeah, I mean, they would definitely tweak some lines sometimes. But yeah, I mean, they didn't usually go like whole off onto some kind of new area. It was usually pretty small tweaks or else just not recording at all.
That happened on Battlefront.
Yeah, it's a lot of waiting, right? Because you have, you know, a determined approval process time. Because one, you need time for a group of people individually to read a script and provide feedback, and then for them to kind of get together and figure out, okay, how do we, what's the presentation of this feedback? Where do we agree? Where do we disagree? Like, they have their own internal process for every single script that comes in on every single project, right? And Story Group at Lucasfilm isn't just working on Battlefront 2, they're working on novels and films and comics and TV shows and every other tie-in you can imagine, because they are the kind of guardians of consistency for Star Wars. They're making sure that every single thing over the next however many years is congruent with each other. And that's like, that is a job I do not know how to do. I admire all of those guys so much, because we would be in a meeting discussing a plot point or a silly reference, or somebody would make an offhanded joke, and every now and then you would have somebody say, oh, that actually really works because of something we can't talk about. And then, you know, many months later you see a film and realize that's the connection. Oh my God, that's wild.
Can you say what the lead time in was for like getting approval on stuff?
I think it was like roughly 2 weeks. Like, we'd send a script and then Walt, my co-writer, and I, we would immediately, because we knew the process would take a while, right? So rather than sit on our thumbs for 2 weeks, we would just start rewriting immediately. So by the time we got our feedback, a lot of the stuff that they had addressed, we also realized, yes, we also found that to be terrible and changed it. But it was still nice to get that external feedback for like, oh, we never thought about things that way, or this doesn't work because of other stuff happening in the franchise, or it's an echo of a beat that you do later on, so we should maybe consider changing it. And just having that top-down view while you're so close to it is so nice, even when it's, you know, it does take time, and it's, I never found it frustrating, but I can understand why some people might. But I love that process of like, it's off, it's with them, I know I'm getting it back with good notes, and we're going to keep making it better all the time.
Yeah, it sounds like good breathing room.
Yeah, it was nice. And we would spend a lot of time on the phone with Lucasfilm, and we went down to Lucasfilm a bunch, right? So there were some times where, you know, we didn't have to really wait for feedback, because we would send them something on Friday and see them Monday, and we'd just go over it the day of and rip it to shreds and rebuild it and have something kick-ass by the end of the day.
Damien, can you say what lead-in time was for you guys?
It kind of changed at various times in the project. I mean, I might write something and then 2 weeks later get an audio delivery with the lines. So yeah. And really, I mean, then there were other things that, you know, went through lots of different iterations, and, you know, South Park themselves were constantly rewriting their own scenes. So, you know, we have, you know, multiple versions of scenes recorded from them.
We haven't talked about it yet, but like, what was the writing process for both of you on your games, if you could say?
Sure. Yeah, I think I can talk about that. I mean, South Park was very heavily involved. I mean, the story is theirs. They wrote the vast majority of the cutscenes and created the cutscenes themselves as well. But you know, we worked with them, you know, talking about, you know, quests and you know, what's going on at this point in the game, and how the combat dialogue needs to flow. But yeah, I mean, the majority of the stuff that I was writing is combat dialogue. Really, I mean, anything that you might hear while you're actually playing the game but not watching a cutscene, but a lot of that is combat.
What was your process like, Mitch?
Lucasfilm was pretty laissez-faire a lot of the time. Like, they obviously had very involved input, but they were never prescriptive about things. They never came back and said, you know, it'd be better is this line of dialogue, or, hey, we rewrote the scene to be X. They were they're very good about having the creators be the creators, and they are kind of a sanity check, and they're a quality check. But it was interesting because I came into, we talked a little bit about like the kinds of scripts that you have in game dev, and very rarely are they final draft screenplays. But in the early days of Battlefront, and I fought off tools as long as I possibly could. But we just did final draft screenplays for the longest time, because we were still, you know, figuring out the building blocks of the game. We had a pretty long pre-production, which was nice. And we basically, for the duration of pre-production, wrote a film. We basically just wrote a movie with our characters, and then piece by piece added on mission chatter and, you know, oh, this would be like a nice moment. We don't know where it's going to be, but this is like a nice character moment during this mission. Let's see if we can find somewhere for it. Oh, this is a good reference to something that happened in a previous mission. Let's try to fit it later on. And then by the time we had levels and we were playing them, we realized, oh my God, I don't understand what's happening, right? Because the script was so thin because it had good character moments and the cutscenes were strong. But when you got down to it, you realized we'd guessed at what a level would be because they were in progress and we could only, you know, we work with what we had. And by the time we started playing the levels, we realized, oh my God, the story, there's not nearly enough dialogue. There's not nearly enough context for what you're doing. I don't understand the mission. I don't understand the intent. We had to really start diving deep on, okay, specifics, mission to mission, beat by beat. What is going on? Every second the player is moving through the level. What's the area look like? What's it full of? Who's there? What can we draw attention to? What do we want to draw attention away from? Are there better moments for this kind of conversation? Because tonally, it doesn't really fit in the action. Narrative was really the tip of the spear for Battlefront 2, and it's an unusual process because games typically don't operate that way. For exactly the reason that we had to make major changes when design became the tip of the spear.
So did you say you were fighting off the tools for the longest time? Was Final Draft what you were using in the end, or do you end up using different tools?
No, we used different tools. We had an internal tool that we used that connected to Frostbite, and I was basically – I tried my hardest to avoid touching Frostbite because I was so afraid of breaking anything. But I did all of my writing for the first year outside of tools, just using Final Draft, using Word for, you know, one pagers, summary documents, world building stuff. The scripts themselves were in Final Draft. And then at one point we basically said, okay, it's tools time. We need to import the Final Draft script into the tool and start using the tool day to day. That's where you need to start adding stuff. And we were developing the tool. It was funny because we were developing the game. We were building the team. We started the studio and we were kind of figuring out how to use this tool most effectively all at the same time. So there was a lot going on during the process of making Battlefront 2 at Motive. But yeah, once we had the tools in place and I had to use them day to day, I became a lot more involved with the level designers, and the level designers were identifying, you know, the kinds of lines they needed, when and how many, and you know, the tool allowed us to do that more rapidly than me sending a bunch of Final Draft stuff off.
And Damian, like, what were the tools you guys were using?
Well, when we were writing scenes, we actually used something called Movie Magic,
oh, yeah,
which is kind of a lesser known cousin of Final Draft, but it's what South Park likes to use. So that's what we were working with. I mean, it's very similar to Final Draft. But then most of the time we were using our own kind of Ubisoft's dialogue and audio tool called Oasis, which for me has an interface that's pretty similar to Final Draft. It's, you know, kind of a screenplay format. But then there's a lot more going on behind the scenes.
Looking at switching topics, so we're speaking more about the industry like as a whole, but when you're playing games now, like what takes you out of one?
For me, I think it's when a character expresses an emotion that I'm not feeling. And I struggle with this because I think that one of my least favorite video game criticisms in history is anybody who says, I disagreed with the ending of The Last of Us. And it's like, well, that's fine. It's not really your decision to make, though, because this is Joel's story. This is Joel's decision. He's making an emotionally charged decision that leads to that finale. And you're not meant to like it. You're meant to think Joel's a piece of shit. You're meant to feel uncomfortable. That's the point. But for me, it's if I'm walking around the world and a character says something like, oh, that's pretty, or that's beautiful, or I think X, and I'm not thinking that, it's like, oh, okay, hang on. Like, you and I are on very different pages right now, video game. Your priorities are over here. Mine are over there. We need to align. We got to figure this shit out.
Damien, what takes you out?
You know, I don't mind if what you were describing, Mitch, about a character articulating something that you don't feel. Like, I mean, I don't mind playing an authored character. I kind of get annoyed with the silent protagonists. It just feels so weird when you see all these cutscenes of all these people talking to you very excitedly, and you just, there's no reply. It's just like a blank wall, and there's no kind of acknowledgement of that. So I would say that bugs me. I don't know if it takes me out, but I mean, it's tricky to have an author protagonist for the same, the same reason that you said, but I feel like that's how you can get a lot more interesting stories.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance. I mean, I say this having written a character who is very opinionated in Battlefront 2, who has her own thoughts and feelings that, you know, I didn't even necessarily agree with all the way through, but that's because she's not me. She's an individual person. She has her own thoughts. But I think it's an interesting balance to strike between having a character who is defined by the choices they make and the action that they partake in, who isn't totally... I think basically what I'm doing and what the character is saying, they have to be aligned, right? You can't have a character who's saying, I'm the best person ever. I'm doing what's right. I'm doing everything. It's all good. But like, you're killing cops and you're doing things that are really horrendous, or you're making, you're doing something super violent, but they're saying we need to, violence isn't the answer. Those kinds of contradictions just don't fit with me at all. And I have a really hard time believing in a character whose core values don't align with the game that they're in.
It's like the Grand Theft Auto 4 problem. I'm this immigrant who's just trying to like get my life in order, and then you can play him as this awful murderer.
Yeah, and it was solved a little bit better in Red Dead, right? Where John's values are very much like, I need to do whatever I need to do because it's my family on the line, and I will go, if I have to be a horrible man, I can do that because I used to be. I'd rather not, but if I have to, I will.
I'm backtracking a ton because I thought about it while we were talking, but are either of you writing your own stuff now, like while you're still writing games, or are you just focused on writing games entirely?
I'm trying to work on an outside project. It's always hard to find the time and especially the creative energy, but I'm trying to work on a script.
Is it like for a game or like?
It's a little bit in flux, but it's not for a game. Maybe more like a TV kind of format.
I specifically try not to write games outside work. One, because it's a conflict of interest, but two, I just, to Damien's point, I just never have the mental energy for that. Like, when I come home, I barely want to play games with narrative in them. Like, I play a lot of Dota 2 because I don't have to think about characters and plots, and I can just click on Little Men in the Jungle, and that's perfect. That's what I need. But I do come home and I do spend a lot of time ideating on short stories that I've had for a while. My Windows screen right now is literally 50% this conversation and 50% Scrivener, as I started to work on like an adaptation for a screenplay just for fun, just for me. Like, I'm never like, oh, I'm going to sell this to Hollywood. Here I come. I'm just like, I like this book a lot. I think it'd be a great movie. I'm just going to write a screenplay.
Yeah, that's always fun. And more about like writing struggles in process. When you're both struggling with a narrative problem, do you have methods or tricks that you use to try to help you with it?
Yeah, like, fucking stop writing. Go for a walk. Don't write. Like, dude, if I'm up against a wall, like, I don't care if I blow a deadline in that moment. Like, if it comes down to your deadline is tomorrow and you got to write it and it's going to be shit, or I'm going to go home and not think about this for 12 hours and be late on my deadline and write it tomorrow, I would way rather blow that deadline. And that's obviously not ideal. Potential future and current employer, please don't judge me for this. But it's something like, if I need to detach from something I can't solve, I'll just stop trying to solve it. Because for me, most of the time, the solutions come with, you take a weekend and you stop thinking about work and you get to work Monday morning. You're like, yeah, I'm fucking ready. Let's do this. Right? That energy is not – that's for real. You need that. And if you don't have it, then you got to get it. And for me, I disconnect and I stop thinking about the project and I don't do work. And I didn't watch Star Wars for a chunk of making Battlefront just because it was too much and I didn't want to get too close to it. And I needed some distance a lot of the time just to make sure that, I could solve the problems I needed to solve.
It's not even that you aren't working on it. Your subconscious is kind of beavering
away
on it.
That's the brutal thing about writing, isn't it? That like you're kind of always doing it 24 hours a day. Which is like, it's a very like tortured artist perspective about writing, but it's true that I go to sleep thinking about story ideas, and I wake up and I go to write shit down, and then I go back to sleep. It's just, it's always on, and everything you're doing is contributing to that future creative output.
How do you explain that then to people who aren't writers and like have them believe you? When they see you just doing like, that guy just got from his desk and walked out of the building. What the fuck is he doing?
That is the struggle. I don't know that I do convince people. Like, I think I explain it and they just think I'm full of shit, and that's fine. Like, I don't know how to articulate that to people who don't. It's a very privileged position to be in, to say I'm just going to disconnect today and that's me doing my job.
Like, it's easy for us to do it because we're freelancers and we can just work from our place. So we just go walk outside, and Max doesn't care if I go outside and do something as long as I get the work done.
And there's two of you. You can just say, fuck it, Max, this is your problem. I'm out.
Exactly. Like, at a studio, I assume it's like, I would just feel ashamed because someone would be watching me and like going, I can't leave now. I got to like, I'm stuck here.
Yeah. I mean, if you're having a tough time, like before you pull the ripcord and just go do something else, you know, I find it helpful if you can go back to an outline and try and solve your problems there, because that's usually where the issue is.
Yeah, I think documentation is huge, right? Like, if you go and you look at your, you know, how does this fit the tone? Does this fit the vision? Does this fit the pillars? Like, all the corporate documentation that you need to make a game is actually really important in solving those issues, right? It's because you might be so off track that you can't even recognize where you went wrong. And if you stack up a script next to documentation that tells you what the game is, oh, it's that, right? That, oh, I'm not remotely near the tone, or I it's not honoring this pillar specifically. Let's rein it back in and get it back on track.
Yeah, if I was having an issue with getting a character's voice right, I mean, I had an easy out. I would just go back and watch a lot of South Park episodes with that character.
See, now that's a good day at work where you're like, oh, I'm just watching South Park for 12 hours. Don't mind me.
That's absolutely work.
I would hope the dream for like working on a Star Wars game is, man, I'm really stuck right now. I need to go visit Lucasfilm and go hang out with the Yoda puppet. Like, that's like my inspiration, yeah. Man. Like, the okay boss.
Exactly.
This is kind of a related question. And maybe it's the same answer for both of you, but when you're feeling down about your writing, how do you get your energy back and how do you get excited about writing again? Or maybe both of you are excited about writing constantly. Like, it's never a problem.
I definitely am not excited about writing constantly. If I ever hit that low point where I'm just like, I'm terrible, this isn't worth it. How did I get here? What am I doing? I'll just go read. I'll read stuff that I know is like, I will seek out my favorite authors and just soak in that writing that I know is good and inspirational and is. It's better than I'll ever be, but man, just reading good writing makes me want to write. It is so powerful in a way that I can't even begin to describe.
Yeah, I totally agree. You just kind of have to retreat to media that inspires you.
So what's the media that's inspiring both of you?
I'm reading a lot of of Elmore Leonard books right now. I'm pretty deep in a rabbit hole right now, and I read through Get Shorty, and I was like, oh, that was really good. I'm gonna watch the movie, and the movie was really good, and that's one of those things that's just so punchy and memorable, and the protagonist is the kind of character you love to hate, but he's so charming, and it's something that it's one of those things that I'll always come back to. Gunsights is a novel that is not like any other novel I've ever read. I think I read it 2 weeks ago and I already, like, I have it on Kindle, but I was like, nope, buying a physical copy because I'm going to read it again. Like, I just was so struck by how different it was as a Western story. It's just not like other Westerns. It wasn't like other novels. I don't know. I love when you find an author like this who you really, really connect with, it's really nice because they kind of become a creative North Star.
What about you, Damian?
I'm a little, let's see, right now. I'm kind of between books, not currently hooked on any TV shows. There's just so many good things to watch that it's hard to settle on one right now. I'm kind of obsessed with like 2 hours of news injection when I get home. It doesn't really leave a lot of room for anything else.
Hard to get inspired by the news.
Yeah, this year.
Yeah, true.
Like, and both of you are talking about like movies and TV and books. Are there games that inspire you, or do you usually like stay away from games when you need to get excited about something?
I mean, there are certainly games that inspire me. I wouldn't say that I go and fire one up like an old favorite when I'm looking for inspiration. I think I'm kind of like you, Mitch, in that I often like to retreat to a game that's a little more systems driven. Like lately, I've been playing a lot of BattleTech from the Harebrained Schemes, who did the Shadowrun series.
Ooh, nice, yeah, that looks really cool.
Totally obsessed with that.
I will say for us, the one that inspired us recently is the third season of The Leftovers, which is incredible and recommend everyone watching it.
I really need to get to that show.
The first season is very depressing, but it gets better. Yeah. Second and third are some of the best television we've ever seen.
I started watching Deadwood recently. I'm watching Deadwood and Justified.
Amazing. It was amazing.
Yeah, they're both great. I'm running through Arrested Development again with my girlfriend who's never seen it. There's something nice about a comedy safety net. Like, I can just throw on The Office at any point, anywhere I am, and be happy.
Hey, Deadwood's pretty funny.
Yeah, it is. It really is in its own horrific way.
Yeah. This question is more for Damien, but I like to hear Mitch's answer too, because it's about comedy and video games, and Star Wars is not a comedy, but it's not like drama all the way through. But comedy and video games, why is it so hard to pull off?
I think comedy in any medium is pretty challenging. But with video games, there are a lot of other unique challenges. I mean, a huge part of comedy is timing, and that's a little harder to control in games. For obvious reasons, you're not really sure when a character is going to go to a certain place or interact with a certain thing. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there are definitely some games that do an amazing job at it that are inspiring. But I agree. It's super hard to pull off.
Yeah, I think to Damien's point about comedy, like, right, you can't control what a player is doing, so you can't anticipate the delivery of something in a comedic way. Like, it's funny too, because comedy and horror are so similar in that horror and comedy both rely so specifically on timing and build up and payoff. But with horror, you can supplement that with dread and music. Like, there isn't, like, you don't have, like, your comedy soundtrack. Like, da-da-da-da-da, you're laughing all the time. Like, it doesn't exist. It would be a problem if it did, because the other problem with comedy is when it's overdone, it's not funny. If you're just beating someone over the head with jokes, it's like, man, fuck, I get it, you're funny. We had that problem with Shriv, our kind of comedic character in Battlefront 2. We had somebody who we wanted to be sort of a misanthrope with a heart of gold. We wanted him to be... You know, because we have characters who are very, you know, they're part of the Empire until they're not. So it's a little doom and gloom for them sometimes. It's nice to give them someone to have some lighthearted conversations with. But we realized pretty early on that he was a joke vending machine, and that was at the point where it's like, well, he's not a character, right? He's not a person. So comedy needs to reflect the internal logic of the world. It needs to be funny in the context of the world it's in, not outside of it. So it's not like you can't just have characters in Star Wars running around like, "Huh, huh, it's lit," and saying like things that are like relevant to what the world is around us. It needs to be.
You can't
get back. You got to get that writing test back. It's like, and South Park's humor is so specific, right? The minute you say like, "Well, my sense of humor isn't like that. I think it'd be funny if we did this instead." It's like, you're not a good fit for this, man. Like, you got to find the voice. You got to find the timing. You've got to give it the room to breathe. You've got to have enough drama between your comedy to make the comedy land. And you can't control when the player is going to see it or how they're going to find it. It's a nightmare. Life is a nightmare.
A related question. What do both of you struggle most with writing? Like dialogue, plot, structure?
Plot for me. Really? I can't, like, I have a really hard time moving something along. I have a really, like, I feel really confident about my dialogue and my characters, but when it comes to like, and then this happens in the room, so they need to do something else, like, I'm totally lost. It's an uphill battle for me.
So how do you conquer that?
I guess it's just through iteration. Like, it's just saying like, I don't know, then this happens, no, that's terrible, and this happens instead, okay, that's better, great. It's just experimentation and exploration, and I've gotten really good at not judging myself too much in those moments. I'm very good at saying, you know, hey, this exists to be shitty, and we all agree that it's shitty, so nobody needs to say it's shitty, and we can just move on and improve it from V1 to V2 to V1000.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same in that plot and structure are still the things that I'm learning the most about. And really, so far, all I've found is just kind of going back to the outline and working on it there. But I'm still waiting for that silver bullet.
Yeah, and plots are weird in games too, right? Because plot is usually action, and because it's a video game, where, you know, dialogue is action, but that only goes so far in a video game. So action is action, and if the player isn't participating in action, they can feel robbed of it. And I have felt this before, where it's like, oh man, like, the character in the cutscenes is way cooler than I am when I play the game. They're doing stuff that I wish I did or that I can't do. And then it starts to feel like, oh, I'm playing like, the story here is really, really strong and the game is really, really strong, but they're not compatible. They don't fit together.
I just lost my train of thought. Sorry.
That's fine. I did that too as I was speaking.
Okay. I'm switching topics again. So you've both been involved in both sides of the industry for at least a decade now. How do you feel storytelling and games have changed? And like, what would be like the highlights and lowlights of the whole storytelling trends and games that pop up to you?
Oh, man.
Oh, wow.
It's a big question.
It's also really hard to talk about lowlights without just like dunking on somebody and being a dick about it.
But you can talk like a storytelling trend, so you're not singling out games.
Yeah. Okay, actually, you know what? I have an example where I can talk about. Okay, so Gears of War is a franchise that, you know, I didn't really connect with like the macho-ness of it all. I'm like the antithesis of an alpha male. So like those are not my dudes, right? Gears 1 through 3, it's like, yeah, okay, I get Marcus and Dom's relationship, but it's meant to be, you know, they're really close, and it's sad that Dom is dead. But in recent time, Gears has become really special to me, and I have really connected to those characters. And I think it was starting with Judgment, when you got to see, okay, they lived lives before this game, or before the three games that I played. And like, I love Gears. I love playing Gears. I like the world. I like the weapons. I like the art. I love the architecture, all of it. But the characters were fun, but they weren't people I loved. But now they are, right? Like with Judgment, I got to see Damon Baird and Augustus Cole and all these guys they led lives that were different before they all knew each other. Gears 5, you got to see the lives that they led in the aftermath of the Gears trilogy. You know, the kids they had, the relationship those kids had, how they grew up, the world they grew up in, that's completely different. Like, it started to feel whole. So it took this story and this world that is, it was just cool in Gears 1 through 3 for me. Like, I was like, yeah, sign me up. It's badass. And it became something that I really connected to. And that the Gears 5 trailer at E3, like, ooh, man, I was all shivers about Kate in that trailer because I'm so excited to see where her story goes and how her connection to Mira leads to, like, all this geeky bullshit that I just never would have expected was me.
Mm. Does anything pop out to you, Dave?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think, you know, you look at the way a lot of games are becoming live games that live on for years. There's an interesting challenge of, you know, how do you bring story into a game that might never really have an ending? Like how do you bring the level of kind of traditionally first person or single player stories into live games? And you know, I don't really have an answer for that yet, but I think it's something that people are thinking about and need to be thinking about. And if we can come up with good solutions to that, it could be really interesting.
I do think it's interesting that we're seeing in the last probably 5 years-ish the trend of, you know, all the people who grew up playing games like me are now the people making those games, and all those people are having kids and starting families. And that's what the games are about, right? These games, like
dad
a lot
games.
Of, yeah, lots of dad games. And like, we very consciously wanted Battlefront to have a mom story. In our expansion, the Resurrection expansion, we want it to be about Aiden and her daughter. You know, me, a mother. It is very important for me to tell. No, it's just interesting to see the kinds of grown-up stories that games are telling and being legitimately grown up about them. Not that I think games need to be grown up. It is interesting to me to see characters like Joel take on a surrogate daughter and connect to this person that he didn't expect, and for Kratos and Atreus to have this meaningful journey together that in the wake of a tragedy brings them closer together. And it's like, these are simple concepts and they're almost cliche concepts when you talk about them reductively, but the execution is so strong because the respect for storytelling in games is so important to these creators that it makes for memorable and distinct experiences. that I'm really glad to see trending the way they are.
I think it'll keep going, even as much as certain people on the internet complain about it.
I mean, you're always going to have your GTAs and your Red Deads, right? Like, I mean, I say this, but I'm like, I'm so excited to play Red Dead and just be an asshole as Arthur Morgan and go around the Wild West being a dick. Those games are always going to exist. Call of Duty and Battlefield games are always going to exist. I'm always going to have my military war stories. I'm always going to have those reliable things. But it's seeing people experiment with the kinds of characters that lead video games and the people they surround themselves with that's really interesting to me.
We talked about this with Janina when she was on the before we recorded with her on the podcast, but do you think we're going to have anytime soon a AAA game, AAA character-driven game that has no combat in it? Because apart from sports games or like driving games, we couldn't think of any AAA games with no combat in it.
Yeah, I was going to say the closest thing I can think of as to like a AAA game with no combat is Longshot, the story mode in Madden, but... I guess I think it would be cool to see somebody really lean in on adventure, like action adventure without a gun is cool, right? Like having the video game equivalent of the Goonies where it's high risk and it's adventurous, but there's no like you're not beating the shit out of anything. It'd be really refreshing. And I think that at a AAA level, that's probably far away. I don't know. I'm trying to think of who would do that.
Until Dawn is kind of close to that, but there was still a little bit of combat in it.
Yeah.
But it's AAA like production values.
Yeah, that really is, I guess, as close as we've come. I think that Quantic Dream Games might be able to explore that well.
Maybe Naughty Dog?
Yeah, well, I was going to say Naughty Dog is like the candidate I go to, right? But then you see the trailer for Last of Us 2 and it's like, oh, maybe not.
I saw someone on the internet joking, but like, Last of Us Part 2, right trigger, shoot. Left trigger, kiss. I'd be up for that. Damon, do you have thoughts?
I mean, it feels like VR would be more amenable space to that kind of game style. But I don't know about... I mean, you said AAA games, so I'm not sure when we're...
It's Valve. That's what they've been working on for all this time. Valve's making AAA nonviolent games.
That'd be amazing.
Yeah, they have In the Valley of Gods now, so they're the AAA devs doing non-combat games.
So then, for both of you, what verbs do you want to see more in games?
Oh, man. I just keep thinking of like lots of huggy-feely kinds of verbs. Like I guess like connect and share, and this isn't even necessarily in a multiplayer context, right? It's like I would love to play a single player game where you connect with another character in a meaningful way that isn't just they're a combat companion. I would love to see a game where, like I said before, adventure, right? Like that's my favorite kind of story. But if you could have an adventure game that is pure adventure, it's risk and it's taking chances and being in dangerous scenarios, but you're not shooting your way out to solve the problem, would be really nice.
I think the verb of tomorrow is defenestrate. I think we need games that are all about that, which is throwing people out of windows.
I'd play that game.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, every conversation ends one way.
It's always that the renegade option in Mass Effect to throw that guy out the window. All right, so last question. How do you feel about like the state of games criticism and influencers and everything?
Damien, do you watch a lot of Twitch?
I wouldn't say a lot.
Yeah, me either. Some, but not a lot.
Yeah, I mean, all the Let's Plays and that sort of thing, it definitely conveys what it's like to play the game more than the tools that we used to have, which was just describing what it was like.
I think there's more theatricality to a Let's Play than there is in the actual experience of playing a game, though. Like, even when I'm playing with friends or my girlfriend, like, I don't think we're really that vocal about, like, every single little thing. Like, I prefer if I'm watching a gameplay video to just watch it pure, right? If I want to see what something's about, I don't need, hey, guys! Like, that... It's so fascinating to me that it's the moment I realized I was an old man is when like I just don't connect to these things anymore, and like it is the most popular content in my like preferred medium. Like I just don't have a connection to it. But like I do enjoy watching people play Twitch and have genuine reactions to the games they're playing. I love to see how people share games together, whether they're building stuff in a collaborative game or like I said before, like I play a lot of Dota 2, so I watch a lot of Dota 2, and it's just fun to see how people engage with that. I guess that's all different from journalism, though, right? Like, that's just video content, which I guess is getting kind of rolled into, like, the journalism content creator influencer bucket.
Yeah. It's kind of like new journalism.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, the way we consume games is so different than it used to be, right? Like, I would read magazines, and that was it. And then those magazines became websites, and now those websites are getting their asses handed to them by 14-year-olds. It's so bizarre. Like, and I do get it. It's just like that kind of content is not for me. I still prefer, like, I read IGN, I read Kotaku. I love Jason Schreier's reporting. I still love to see the IGN crew doing roundtable discussions, and podcasts are still big for me. Huge in terms of like how I consume news and get like different perspectives on various aspects of the industry. Live stuff like Kinda Funny, I think, is really great because you have people reacting to the news live and delving into it in ways that are different than your typical news article, which is just, here's the facts. Which for me, like, that was literally my job for 2 years. I was a news editor. I did that. But I love the discussions that forms, right? I love the features that people write out of that. And I love that it's still prevalent. It's not going away.
I'm with Mitch in the old man camp, but I think I'm in the even older elderly man camp where, you know, I'm interested to see a trailer when a game is announced or first gameplay or something like that. And I'll watch it. I'll be like, great. I'm really looking forward to that game when I play it in like 1 or 2 years, but I'm don't really need to follow all the information that comes out about it between now and then. I just, when it's out, I can't wait to check it out. But yeah, when I feel like, you know, when I'm really deep into playing a game like BattleTech, you know, or whatever that I'm really into, because I tend to be the kind of gamer who plays one game for months at a time, if possible. I mean, I'll be checking out that game's forums on the publisher developer site every day, or the Reddit forum or whatever, just kind of taking in, you know, what people are talking about it, or, you know, various strategies. That's kind of the majority of gaming info that I absorb.
Do you miss it ever, Damien? Like, do you miss contributing to those conversations or spotlighting games like that, or having like long articles about something like BattleTech that people might not be super aware of?
I kind of don't. No, I just kind of like enjoying it in my own personal way, yeah, rather than talking about it being my job, because that kind of lessens the enjoyment in some ways for me.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people feel differently there. I talked to some people who we used to be journalists and no longer were, and they kind of miss having a forum to, you know, express their ideas and thoughts about things, but I don't really.
Do you ever think about doing your old jobs, but today, and like if you would even survive?
I don't know that I would.
Would you be an influencer? Would you streaming on Twitch every day?
I don't think I've got the. I don't have the Hey Guys personality to pull it off.
No, I don't have that. Like, it's funny too, because at IGN we were all in on video, right? And it's more so now, like, there's more video hosts and a lot of the editorial staff have become video producers and on the video team. So it's, I don't know, like, I don't think that I would survive, because I don't think editorial would survive the next 5 to 10 years. But I guess I said that 5 to 10 years ago, that editorial's on the way out and video's on the way in. So hopefully there's a happy coexistence between them now. But yeah, I don't miss it. I did love it. I'm sure that I would love to, you know, I'd love to write about some games sometimes, but I'm perfectly happy to just write games and then come home and read books and play Dota 2. It's nice.
That's a good note to end on. So where, Damien, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter, Damien_Lin.
And it's DEMIAN.
Yeah, I make it tough for everyone. It's DEMIANLINN.
Awesome. What about you, Mitch?
I am Mitchy D on Twitter. That's kind of it.
You can find this podcast at ScriptLockCast on Twitter. Please leave a review if you like it. And that's it. Thank you, too, again, for coming on.
Of course. Yeah, thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Super fun.